Great. So some of you may be familiar with the shock and kill approach to cure HIV infection. So this idea was launched about 6 years ago by Stephen Deeks and others. And the idea is that in patients on stable long-term ART, you induce a shock agent, a so-called latency reversing agent, to try to purge out viruses from latently infected cells. So when these cells then are reactivated and start producing virus, that would enable the immune system to recognize the cells and kill the cells, or the cells may even undergo death due to cytopathic effects from virus production. So this is kind of the overall concept. And if this worked 100%, then we would have eliminated the latent reservoir. So the whole idea is we have a... Each person with HIV infection has a reservoir of a certain size, and usually we say it's around 1 million cells that have replication-competent virus integrated into its DNA. The idea with shock and kill is that we gradually reduce the size of this reservoir. Bob Silicanos and others have modeled how this latency reversing effect should work if this was to be a successful strategy, and they have estimated that we need to reduce the size of latent reservoir by something like 99.9% to really see a significant increase in time to viral rebound of up to, say, 1-2 years. So we need a really very effective regimen for this to work in vivo. So where are we now with... in terms of latency reversal, the first to show that we could reverse the latent state of infected cells was Dave Margolis at UNC and his co-workers, who showed that a single dose of vorinostat increased mRNA transcription in resting memory CD4 T cells by about fivefold. So in this study, they just gave one pill, a single dose, and measured transcription before and after. They didn't see any increase in terms of virus in the plasma of these patients, and they didn't see any effect on the size of the reservoir. But at least this was a proof of principle that we could reverse latency in patients. So we did a study a few years back with another latency reversing agent, also from the same class of drug called HDAC inhibitors. This drug was panobinostat, and we were also able to show that panobinostat could also induce spikes in HIV transcription as a proof that we increased transcription in latently infected cells. Interestingly, in the same study, we also saw an increase in protein expression in CD4 T cells in a study that we did together with Bonnie Howell and some co-workers at Merck. So not only can we increase transcription, we can also increase protein expression, which is needed if the cells are to be recognized by the immune system. In a different study we did with a drug called romidepsin, we were also able to show that not only did we increase transcription and protein expression, we could also get to a stage where using a standard Cobas-Tagmann assay, we could measure quantifiable increases in plasma viremia up to around 120 copies in 5 of the 6 patients that received this drug. So again, this was just a small pilot study, but it's demonstrated that we could reverse latency to a stage where we would see increases in plasma viremia. Just as a discussion of, are we only targeting a few cells with these latency reversing agents, or are we targeting broadly the reservoir? In a study we did in collaboration with Sarah Palmer and one of her PhD students, we showed that we broadly increased transcription across the reservoir. When we looked at induced RNA, we could match that to DNA across a broad number of clones, suggesting that these latency reversing agents broadly induce transcription across the reservoir. So these are the latent subversion agents that have so far been tested in clinical trials, at least that I know of. And the top three ones are all HDAC inhibitors. Then we have disulfiram, which is an anti-alcoholic drug. Briostatin, which is a PKC activator. And then two agents that target the innate immune system, a TLR7 agonist, and you probably heard Romas talk about there, a TLR7 agonist yesterday, and a TLR9 agonist that we have also tested. I'll show you more about that later. So you can see there's probably a difference in potency in these latent subversion agents. Vorinostat has never been shown to induce plasma viremia, whereas both panobidinstat and romdepsin have. And some of these agents, such as briostatin, had absolutely no effect on transcription or plasma viremia. So what effect do these agents have on the size of the reservoir? These are four of the compounds I just showed you, and on the y-axis you have change in HV DNA, and basically they have zero effect on the size of the proviral reservoir. We know that most of the integrated HV DNA is not viable, is not replication competent or intact proviruses. It represents dead-end viruses that cannot be transcribed into a fully functional infectious virion. But using this measure, there's absolutely no effect on the size of the reservoir. We also know that when these patients, this is data from panobidinstat study, when they interrupt treatment, they all rebound. So not only can we not detect a significant change in the reservoir, we also see viral rebound once patients stop ART. So the question is the shock too weak? Are too few cells being reactivated? Is the killing not occurring as we had hoped, maybe because of inadequate antiviral immune responses, both innate and adaptive? Or are we simply not choosing the right time to intervene? Should we try a different time in the course of infection? So to address one of these questions, we combined an HV vaccine called VAC4X from the company Bionor with romidepsin to see if the combination could have an effect on the size of the reservoir and viral rebound. So this study included 20 patients that were all enrolled at our site in Aarhus. In this study, we could see a small but significant decline in total HV DNA of around 40%. A similar but smaller decline was observed in integrated HV DNA. This was not significant. So we, of course, asked the patients to interrupt ART to see if this had an effect on time to viral rebound. But again, we observed the exact same time to viral rebound of around 14 to 15 days median, which is basically the number that we see and many others see when you do these treatment interruptions. So getting back to the TLR9 or the TLR agonist, so this is a different type of compound because this is a compound that stimulates the innate immune system through PDCs. So PDCs have both TLR7 and TLR9 receptors, and once these PDCs become activated, they migrate to lymphoid tissues, to lymph nodes, and so forth, and activate T cells there, and also increase cross-presentation and other adaptive features. We did a single-arm study with a TLR9 agonist called MGN1703, in which 15 patients received this compound for 4 weeks. We measured PDC activations, which is, as I said, the target cell for this compound, and we could see a clear increase in both activation and in the expression of T cell co-receptors such as CD40 and CD86. We also saw a very clear type 1 interferon response when we looked at cells from gut biopsies. Almost exclusively was type 1 interferons that were induced. We saw very little type 2 or detrimental inflammatory responses, which also corresponds very well with the safety profile of this drug, which is excellent. Basically, patients don't experience any symptoms such as fever or chills or anything when they receive this drug. So it's really well tolerated. And when we look in these gut biopsies for upregulation of viral proteins such as MX1, we see a clear increase from baseline to on treatment. We also know that this drug can increase NK cell activity. Ex vivo, it increases NK cells' ability to mediate viral inhibition. And in vivo, we also see an increase in the activation of cytotoxic NK cells. Interestingly, in these 15 patients, six of them had blips of quantifiable viremia during the treatment. So this is the mechanism is much more indirect than with HDAC inhibitors that work directly on T cells. T cells don't express TLR9. So the effect is more indirect if we think this is latency reversing agent. So this is not complete clear-cut proof that it's a perfect shocking agent, but we do see patients that have blips up to 1,500 copies in this study. So because this was only a very short study, we considered if dosing for 24 weeks rather than just 4 weeks might have a significant effect on the reservoir and could lead to both improved immune responses and maybe a decline in the size of the reservoir. So we asked patients to, the same patients that were in the previous study, to take this drug for 24 weeks. And 12 did. And again, we could see, I'm not going to repeat the same data, but just showing that we could see increases in all the different immune parameters that we were expecting, and we could also see an increase in HV-specific CD8-T effector memory cells that produce more interferon gamma during the course of treatment than they did at baseline. So it not only increases just innate immune responses, but also in adaptive immune responses. We didn't see any significant decrease in HIV DNA in this cohort, and when we asked patients to interrupt treatment, it looked very much like the data I showed you before. The only outlier we had was one patient that went for almost 24 weeks before rebounding, and this patient didn't have any characteristics that you would normally associate with post-treatment control or elite control. He had a medium-sized reservoir. He had an age that was in the exact medium. We could easily induce viruses from his reservoir before he went on treatment interruption. So we're not really sure why he controlled for such a long time, but we're trying to figure that out. All right, so I'll just say a little bit very briefly about the upcoming trials that we have in Aarhus. We have one which has the acronym ROADMAP, which is basically combining broadly neutralizing antibodies with romidepsin to really see if we can observe this effect of a combined effect from a kick with a very effective effector mechanism such as broadly neutralizing antibodies. So it's also enrolling at Rockefeller University in New York and in Cologne. A different study is looking at when to intervene. So all the studies that have been conducted in HIV cure up until now has been in chronically well-treated patients. So we have a study enrolling right now where we try to intervene as patients are starting ART. So within the first week of starting ART, we give them broadly neutralizing antibodies or romidepsin or both. So it'll be interesting to see if that both leads to a quicker suppression of plasma viremia, but also maybe to a decrease in the reservoir. Lastly, there's a study that I just want to mention where we're combining a TLR9 agonist also with broadly neutralizing antibodies. And this is more with the aim of inducing immunological control than really as a shock and kill strategy. So I think not only us, but also others are thinking whether the shock and kill strategy will really be the right way forward, because we know it works, but we don't see any decrease in size of reservoir. We don't see a delay in time to viral rebound. We know that we can induce broad reactivation, but some ex vivo and in vitro studies that I haven't shown you also suggest that we are only maybe targeting a fraction of the reservoir. And really, for this strategy to be effective, we need to target a vast majority of the reservoir. We probably also need to induce some sort of long-lasting potent immune surveillance mechanisms. So lastly, I just want to show you the opposite concept, which is called the block and lock strategy. So compared to shock and kill, where you can find a lot of literature, you can find very little literature on this topic, but it's basically the reverse idea. So instead of inducing viral transcription, this strategy aims to block viral transcription from occurring at all. So the idea is to treat with something that inhibits reactivation of viruses and then to see if we you can completely prevent the reservoir from being reactivated once you withdraw ART. So this has primarily been promoted with a TAT inhibitor by Susanna Valenti and her group. And they have shown in different studies that cortistatin A, which is a specific TAT inhibitor, can inhibit viral transcription. And there's a chemical, so this compound was isolated from a sea sponge, but they managed to produce a chemical compound which is called a dehydrocorticostatin A, which is very easy to manufacture and produce and looks a lot like a steroid. So they have shown that in cell cultures, in a very complicated setup that I'll not go through in details, they have shown that this compound both can lead to a quicker suppression of virus production in cells from HIV patients, and it can also lead, once they withdraw ART and this this compound DCA, the cells in culture, there's less virus in the supernatants once they withdraw this therapy. And in humanized mice, a BLT model, they showed a very similar finding that in mice that had been treated with this DCA, so the TAT inhibitor, compared to untreated mice, they rebounded later, and they also appeared to have rebound at a lower level than untreated mice. Just shortly, heat shock protein is an inducer of HIV transcription, and there are also inhibitors of heat shock protein 90 being developed for lymphomas and solid malignancies, and these compounds can also inhibit reactivation of HIV. It has been shown ex vivo. Something that is interesting with these compounds is that they are actually in a phase 1 and 2 development for these malignancies, so there is actually a path forward to test these in humans. But so far, the log and shock or log and block strategy has only been tested on cells and in humanized mice, so we don't know how this will play out in humans, but at least in these models, it seems to actually suppress both virus production and reactivation of latently infected cells. So we'll see how this plays out. There's an ongoing trial in China, which, according to clinical trials, was started in 2014, but there are no data yet, with a TAT inhibitor compound called triptotolide. But yeah, we'll have to wait to see human data. But I think it's a strategy worthwhile considering, and it's at least as legitimate as shock and kill. So these are all the people that helped me create these data, and I want to thank all of them, and of course the study participants that have volunteered to participate in these studies and to donate tissues and blood in large quantities, I have to say. So a lot of thanks goes to them too. So.
So thank you very much. So comment, question, yes, Vincente.
You mentioned gene editing in one of your last slides. Can you comment, which is probably one of the major challenges using gene editing for a virus like HIV?
Gene editing, yes. So there are different strategies for gene editing. So there's a strategy where you try to actually excise the integrated HIV DNA using CRISPR-Cas or a similar gene editing technology. So this works really well if you have a clonal virus and you have your cells in a petri dish or whatever, but it's really difficult to deliver CRISPR-Cas in vivo. And this is not only a challenge in HIV, it's a challenge with whatever system that you want to use CRISPR-Cas for. I think the main challenge with that strategy is really delivery and also the the diversity of the reservoir in patients. That is, you need to target a lot of different viruses to have that strategy to work. So that's one, and the other one is, of course, to have CC5 editing or have the CCI5 gene cut out. So this seems to be somewhat working in the Sanganmo trials, at least in some patients, and I know they're doing it in HIV patients that have various hematological malignancies that needs to have a stem cell transplant. They also do it, but I haven't seen the data, and I think it's still very old days for gene editing.
Very nice talk. So what do you think is the reason that you can only activate a small minority of the reservoir with LRAs?
That's a great question, Alexander. So what's the reason? I think that there are many reasons. I think these cells, they are resting memory cells. They are not very easy to wake up, so to say. I think that's a major issue. Even when you do ex vivo PMA stimulation in the viral outgrowth assay, Bob Silicano has shown you can do that one time, you get certain amount of positive wells, and you can do it a second time on the negative wells and get more positive wells and so forth. So I think it's really hard to wake these cells up and induce viral transcription. We also don't know exactly about the distribution of where these latently infected cells, where they hide. They might hide in the CNS, they may hide in other immune-privileged sites where it's really hard to get your drug too. So that's another reason, but again, maybe combinations are needed. But yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So the next presentation as a plenary session will be Christina Psomas from Montpellier, and she will